A companion piece to essentially cinema's genre-bending The Fly and Dune, Ben had a chance to sit down with Rick Schmidlin, producer's assistant on the 1986 film The Fly. Here, behind-the-scenes reflections on Rick's set experience, producer Mel Brooks' comedic reaction to selected insert shots, and how a set prop was eventually fitted into a motorcycle part. This is Essentially Cinema Presents A Fly on the Wall, recollecting an on-set experience with Rick Schmidlin.
Welcome to this special episode of Essentially Cinema. We are pleased to be joined by The Fly associate producer, Rick Schmidlin, who's on the line with us. Rick, thank you for your time this morning. The film is wonderful. Actually, when we recorded our episode a few weeks ago and I had prepped for it, it was the first time that I'd seen it. But I'd heard so many wonderful things about it over the years. How did you get involved with the film?
Okay. First, I was the producer's assistant.
Yeah. Okay.
Not associate. And basically what happened was, I'll tell you how it all starts. My best friend was Ray Manzarek from The Doors.
Oh.
And we were at Sony one day to meet with James Toback, who wanted to talk about the Doors feature, which Oliver Stone originally took.
Mm-hmm.
And we were standing outside the executive office, and out comes Stuart Kornfeld, who introduces himself after it was just Ray and I, and tells us that he was a big fan of The Doors. And then I said, you know, I had been the lighting director for the rock band X. And Stuart said, you want to hang out in my office for a little while? Come on up. So he went up into his office in Sony. From that point on, Stuart and I became friends. Stuart had worked on, had gone to AFI with David Lynch. And basically what he had done was he had gotten David Lynch, he was assistant at Brooks Films, to get David Lynch to direct Elephant Man. And then later on for Brooks, he worked on assistant on The History of the World and on the an associate producer or producer on Fatso. So you'd have to check those credits, but that's what Stuart had done. And because of all the work he had done for Mel Brooks, Mel gave him a development deal to put together The Fly. And this was back in, I would say, around 82.
Okay.
Then he eventually moved to the MGM lot and basically kept on working on The Fly, trying to get good scripts done. But I would visit like him as other producers as I was trying to get my career going. And that was good. Also, he liked the bands I worked with. So eventually I would get him to see when I was doing lights for Los Lobos or for X or the Blasters, Stuart would come as my guest. So we became friends and he was working on getting The Fly. Finally, he was happy enough that he got David Cronenberg to agree to direct it. And he was getting ready to do this. At this point, I was working on the movie Hoosiers, a location manager, my first credit. So Stuart went up to Canada to work with Cronenberg. I had come back after working on Hoosiers. Then I had gotten a call from Hemdale Films that they wanted me to go out to the Philippines to work on as location manager on a film and the Oliver Stone film Platoon. And I was thinking about that and thinking I was going to take that job. And then one morning I got a phone call around 9 o'clock. My wife had gone to work and I got a phone call at 9 o'clock in the morning. It was Stuart. Rick, I want to offer you a job as my assistant. Can you come up to Canada and work on The Fly? Well, I loved Scanners. I loved Dead Zone. And I thought, wow, Stuart, this is great. So he goes, that's good to know because I'm going to offer you. And he told me the sum amount of money that he was going to give me, which was a very nice sum of money.
Yeah.
And then he said to me, so you can work on it? And I said, yes. And he goes, good, because the car is going to pick you up in 2 hours. And I have a plane booked for you already. So basically, I had to call my wife and say, I'm on my way to Canada. She was at work. And there I was, within 2 hours, on my way to LAX airport to fly to Toronto to work on to go to work on the fly. So I got into Toronto, and they put me up in a nice hotel there. And the next day, I met with Stuart for breakfast. And basically, Stuart's what I had found out was that the film had been shooting for about 2 weeks. And Stuart was so involved in the film for 4 years, and he great guy. But he was with Cronenberg constantly. Like Cronenberg would shoot something, and Stuart said, "Do you think you can try that?" Cronenberg would shoot something else. Stuart would say, "Can you shoot something like that?" And so on. So he was basically trying to get David to shoot extra scene, extra footage that Stuart was asking for, because he was involved with the film. Well, what had happened was Cronenberg told Stuart he was not allowed on the set anymore for the shooting because he was interfering, telling actors the things to do, you know, getting too involved in the production. Mm-hmm. And so he was not allowed on the set. But he did have a solution for Stuart, which was Stuart could have a proxy that sat on the set and watched the entire film be shot, except for the first 2 weeks that had been shot, and then could report to Stuart in the afternoon, evenings, what had been done on the set. And so that was my job. So my job was to sit next to David and watch him shoot the entire movie.
Wow.
Which was every scene that was shot in the loft, in the doctor's offices, and in the office basically the doctor's office, and then in the apartment. Okay. Where those scenes were shot. So basically, the only thing I had missed was the restaurant scene, the scene at the bar where he arm wrestles.
Yes.
And basically a street scene. Everything else I had been that I was going through. So I would go there and be with the crew, be with everybody, be able to sit, not be able to, you know, no comments, just be able to watch and tell Stuart. Then I was also privileged to be at every meeting that Stuart had with David and every production meeting. So it was kind of like, you know, being the fly on the wall. and that was what my job was on the film, was to watch what was going on. Even at one point, we had one rainy Saturday afternoon where in the middle of the shoot, David and Stuart were going to get together and just have an afternoon together drinking wine. And I was the third person invited. It was just the three of us. We had wine, and I had gotten from a place called Budget Video, which was in the beginning of the home video market. David had never seen any Herschel Gordon Lewis movies.
Okay.
So I got Blood Feast and 10,000 Maniacs, or 2,000 Maniacs, I guess it was. And we watched those films and just got to discuss things. Also, whenever there was a lunch with Stuart, with any of the cast members, John Getz or Jeff Goldblum or Gina, I was also invited to. So basically, I was the guy who could be anywhere on the set at any time watching everything. And that was my job. And just tell Stuart at the end of the day, yeah, David did a great job. He did good. And so that was my involvement right there from the beginning. And that was pretty exciting because I got to see a production be shot.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, you know, looking at the movie today, the effects hold up very well. It's extremely well shot. What was David like on the set? I know you weren't there for the first 2 weeks, but what was David like on the set as he was trying to compose his shots? It sounds as if there was some conflict between what the producer was looking for and the director's intent. And I think there was, you were there to find a middle ground, or at least facilitate a middle ground.
Well, the whole thing was David was very meticulous on the set. He had done Scanners, mm-hmm. which we all liked early on, and Dead Zone, yep. and Videodrome. And basically, David was very articulate in the way he did things. He was also we bonded because we were both into motorcycles. And the cylinders, the pods, were actually turned over Ducati cylinders. He was into Ducati motorcycles. So that's how they were designed.
Wow.
And so that's what the pods are. If you look at a Ducati cylinder, mm-hmm. you'll see the pods. And basically, David was very, very articulate, very respected, because the crew that he worked with was all the crew that he had a stable crew. He had a crew. He had a sound man that didn't speak English, but the boom man did. But he had French Canadian people. He had people. His sister Carol worked in wardrobe. There was a lot of people working there. One of the things that was going on that was discussed with the set, one crew member, I don't remember exactly his name offhand.
No worries.
Had AIDS at the time. And basically what was discussed was how David was directing, though it wasn't, you know, publicly ever said, but what was discussed a lot was the crisis that was going on, because we're talking about 1985.
Yes.
And basically what David's theme was something that was irreversible. So he really did have a sense of the crisis. So when Brundle becomes affected mm-hmm. by the fly, it's something that's going to deteriorate him
yep.
and change him. That was almost a metaphor to the crisis that was going on at that time that David was seeing. So what happened was that, you know, I've never heard it mentioned that way, but that's what was going on. And that was what was going on during the production, because one of his trusted crew members was sick and still working with us. And so basically, when you watch The Fly, and I rewatched it the other day too, just so I would jog my memory, because I hadn't really watched it in full in a long, long time, was that that's what's happening with Brundle, as, you know, he is going through all these things, and the relationship of the partner, which is Gina Davis, mm-hmm. you know, of what he's seeing in the deterioration of somebody she loved, and nothing could be controlled.
Right.
So David was into that. One of the most interesting things was that happened during the shooting was we shot the scenes in where he did all what we called, he had a microscopic eye. So he would do things to detail, like the fingers and the ear falling off and all that, and that stuff being put in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And we shot that. And then the big thing was we were having a special visit, VIP visit. It was going to be Mel Brooks was going to come up to see how the show was going. We were at the Kleinberg Studios, which was about an hour outside of Toronto, which was being shot during the winter months, January, February, very cold outside. And so Mel shows up and we go into a small room that holds about 20 people to watch the dailies. And what happens is it's basically Mark Irwin, the cinematographer, David Coatsworth, the production manager, myself, Stuart was in there at the time because he was close to Mel, and about 10, Jeff and Gina, and John Getz, I think, was still there at that time. And we were all in this little screening room, and Mel was watching the dailies of all these things falling off of Brundle. Well, Mel, it had to be the funniest moments I have ever seen in my entire life. Mel cracked jokes on every single shot he saw. Spot on jokes, jokes that just gave you belly laughs, totally spontaneous. And that was definitely, you had 20 people laughing and almost falling on the floor as Mel was describing what he was watching with all these grotesque shots on the screen. And that was something you just never forgot.
Right. It's funny. You don't, when you think of Mel Brooks, you don't think of a horror film. And The production deal that he made with Stewart makes perfect sense, because Mel Brooks, as an entrepreneur, wants to expand his horizons. But to hear that story about being able to crack those types of jokes at such horrific scenes, I wasn't there, but yeah, you know, your story, I can only imagine how funny that actually was. He seems like he can take, like you, he can take in a situation and observe it and make the best reaction possible. And I'm really impressed, because that's not an easy thing to do.
No, it isn't. And you got to remember, Mel had been the executive producer of Elephant Man.
Yes.
So, but Mel had different things he wanted to do. And according to Stewart, Mel's goal in life was to have a production deal in every studio in town.
Mm-hmm.
So basically that was interesting. So to see Mel with Cronenberg, you know, was a priceless moment.
Yeah.
It was also great to work with John Getz, who was a very down-to-earth guy, mm-hmm. Non-infected movie star, because John, we had all admired John because we had just seen Blood Simple. That had been a film that had come out about a year before.
Yeah.
And basically, Blood Simple came out, and that's just a call that I don't need to take, so if you hear a buzz. So Blood Simple came out, and John was there. So I got to spend a lot of time with John, because he was the guy who wanted to go out. We went to a car show together. No one ever recognized him, because no one really could, you know, he wasn't a star. And John's idea was that he just wanted to make movies and never be a star, but have enough, because he had a boat in Long Island, and that's what he was financing.
I gotcha.
So. So John wasn't that, but of course there we are with John Getz from Blood Simple.
Yep.
Jeff and Gina were having a relationship at the time. Then they were madly in love, so they were a couple.
Yep.
And it was always interesting when all of a sudden Jeff was in the rubber suit, which Stéphane Dupérez had put together. And what was something funny that a lot of people don't realize is, or would never have expected, and we can only envision what this must have been like. They were really hot for each other.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a fly put in his fly suit. So I'm just imagine, yep, what was going on with that scene. That wasn't something that was ever, you know, a shot, of course, but definitely, you know, he had to have something so that if he needed to go to the bathroom, but everyone always wondered what else was going on with Jeff and Gina.
Right, right.
Because they would disappear for a while. And of course, he prepared her for the next film she was going to do. And next thing you know, she jumped up to Rennie Harlan. But she was very hot on Jeff Goldblum at the time. So they were a real couple during the shooting.
It really shows on the, oh, I'm sorry. It really shows on the screen.
Yes, it does. And the one scene, one of the greatest moments I had was that we had on the second stage in Kleinberg, a revolving set. That was the set for when you see Jeff, you know, doing like the Fred Astaire, you know, going on the wall, on the ceiling,
yep,
you know, going over. And it was a revolving set that would just revolve. And it was a recreation of the original set that was right next door on the other soundstage. And I was the one that was assigned to go with Jeff to help him rehearse those scenes.
Wow.
So that was really exciting, because, you know, he wasn't in costume, but we, at that time, we were able to talk about a lot of the other work that he'd done. He, like, you know, and about his career in Nashville, Annie Hall, and other things that Jeff had been involved in. And that worked in, really well, and we got along really well on that. But the whole thing was, it was the Cronenberg crew. I was one of the only outsiders. Chris Whalis was another outsider who they brought in, who did all the making of all the latex stuff, the plastic stuff. They had a little in the other room, a complete lab of people making all these kind of things, like the things that would explode when Brundle explodes. It was basically condoms filled with spaghetti. And they were creating all kinds of weird stuff. So I got to see all that being created too. And as I say, it was interesting. It was a great thing. They welcomed me. And it was like, it was an hour ride to get there and snow outs and everything else. It was freezing cold out there, but the crew welcomed me and was happy because they knew I was just having the time of my life.
Yeah.
You know, sitting watching David Cronenberg direct a movie and being amongst everybody else.
And then talking about it 35 years later.
Yeah, and then I have it. It's in storage now, but there was only one book that came at the end of it. Mm-hmm. I got a gift, which was nice because I was into getting a Harley, which I did later after the filming of this. Mm-hmm. But I was interested in motorcycles, and David was obsessed with Ducati, as I say. He loved motorcycles. So there was a book that was in like a little production office there. That said, it was the films of David Cronenberg. Of course, the films of David Cronenberg weren't that many, mm-hmm. but the book was very thin at the time. And then it stamped inside, it said, "Office copy, do not remove." And he gave it to me at the end that said, "To my barbarian motorcycle buddy from hell, David."
That's awesome.
That was a very nice gift.
I imagine.
But the whole thing was that what he was doing, as I say, it was the times. A couple fun things happened. They had a minor tremor earthquake when we were on the set.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very minor. And I was in my office at the time. They were just setting up stuff. And next thing I knew, two-thirds of the crew had come up the stairs and were filling the hall, coming to my office to find out what to do because I was a Californian guy. And how did I handle an earthquake? Because they had never felt it before.
Right.
It was also the time that the space mission went up and exploded and they were lost. And that was the emotional tears on the set. And they kind of treated it like, to me, it was a personal loss.
Mm-hmm.
But the tears on the set were true. And they were all very emotional and very, they felt the loss, but they felt the loss of, like, for instance, people like myself and Chris and a few of the people that were from the States.
Yeah.
Another thing that happened, which was toward the end that was interesting, was Stewart was marrying a performance artist named Johanna Wendt. And because he was very much into the arts,
mm-hmm.
And very much into the avant-garde. And so we went back down, and then we had to go back and shoot about a week's worth of scenes. The scenes where Brundle, Goldblum character, is on the rooftops.
Yeah, okay.
Looking down and going on the roofs. And Stewart couldn't go because he was going on his honeymoon. So he had me go up there and act as the producer for those shots.
Wow.
So I got to be there, and we were all bundled up. It was cold. It was probably mid-March in Toronto, and we were on the rooftops in this alleyway. And I was the go-to person, and I was the producer, proxy producer during just like for that little what would be like a second unit or something.
Gotcha.
So it was just an experience of learning and watching a master direct and direct what is arguably most people think his best film.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah. And basically to be able to be there, you know, and watch how he was creating a property that was not his, where the other ones had been his,
mm-hmm.
This had come from different writers. And in fact, there had been one director, that was originally going to do the film because Cronenberg wasn't available. And unfortunately, his wife and his children were in a car crash and died, so this director could not do the film.
Right.
And then it was available for David to come back and do the film. But David had not the screenplay. He doesn't have the screenplay credit, and it was a film that it was a work for hire. Mm-hmm. But it was David's first studio film. All the films he had done before were independents.
Okay.
This was first working for MGM as a studio director. The reason they shot it, Stuart wanted to shoot it in Canada, was because they had a $9 million budget, but they could get it. But in Canada, because of the rate of exchange, it would be $12 million. So that was one of the reasons why it was shot in Canada. And then I was paid in the United States, so I didn't even have to worry about anything.
Right.
When I went up, in Canada, the border was very loose at that time. Mm-hmm. And so when I went up, it was right after the Academy Awards. So I guess it was end of February. When I went up for that evening shot, I go through the border and they said to me, what are you doing? And I said, I'm here to do a second unit shoot on a David Cronenberg film. And they said, are you in the film industry? I said, yes. And he said, who won the Academy Award last night? And they, of course, they knew if I was in film, I had seen the Oscars.
Right.
So I had to tell them who the best actor was, who the best actress was, and what the best film was at the time. So that was how I got through the border. That was the quiz that was used at that time. But overall, it was interesting to watch David work because he was very articulate. Jeff and Gina knew that they were on an important film. He had worked with John Getz. I think that was someone Stuart wanted because of Blood Simple. He loved the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
But he worked with these people. Then there was very few people, other people involved. David plays the gynecologist in the film.
Yes, I saw him pop up and my eyes just went wide. And kudos to him for making a cameo in his own film. It really speaks to his commitment to ensuring, from my perspective as a viewer and as a film critic, it ensures his commitment to the film as a whole, because he's seeing the product from both sides. And even though it was a small role, it was really nice to see him on the screen. And, you know, that the entire cast, my hat's off to you and to the entire cast and crew for the film. It holds up. It is really an exceptional film. I'm still chuckling at the pods becoming cylinders on a Ducati motorbike. That's an impressive transition. You transitioning just slightly from The Fly, you are a film preservationist and archivist. Am I right in saying that?
Yes. Yeah, because of working on those films, I got to do things I wanted to do. I worked out with Stuart on a film after that called Moving, a Richard Pryor film, which is one of Richard Pryor's last that Stuart produced. And after that, I didn't. What I had to go through to join the union was going to be very little pay where I could make more money. I had done a lot of MTV videos at that time. And so I started to do some of my own things and find my own path. For a while, I worked for Frank Zappa, which was a friend of Stewart's. Mm-hmm. And then I wound up working for Easy Riders magazine for about 5 years.
Wow.
Where I had seen Mike Nesmith's Elephant Parts home video, and I thought the home video market was good. So I produced for 4 years, I did about 12 or 13 of them, Easy Riders home videos, every 3 months, an hour long video. And I had about a $60,000 budget. So it gave me a chance to work with footage, do things, direct and produce live shoots, look with archival footage. And that was a real great experience. At the same time, I had done Doors home videos. So I was good friends with Louis Fiola, who was the president of MCA Home Video, which led me to be able to get the green light eventually to do Touch of Evil.
Yes.
Which would probably be I've done a lot, but that would be my success that most people are familiar with. So I was able to do the re-edit of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, but it all blends together when you're You're young and hungry in Hollywood.
Yep.
And I just did not see myself being a crew member all the time and working on The Hoosiers and The Fly in a one-year period of time was rewarding. Stewart went on to basically run, he passed away about a year ago or so. He went on to run Ben Stiller's company.
Okay.
And that's where Stewart went. He and Ben Stiller were friends, and he started running Ben Stiller's company. But Stewart was an AFI guy into the avant-garde, and he knew what he wanted to do. So we would see each other occasionally, but these were magic moments. And then other films that I did, I got to work for the studios. I produced the reconstruction of Eric von Stroheim's Greed or Elvis, That's the Way It Is. Last film was the lost Lon Chaney film, Houdini film, The Grim Game. Mm-hmm. I did Lon Chaney's London After Midnight. So I got to do my things, and I have, and I wanted to go in my direction. The whole crew thing was kind of fun, but it was not something I wanted to do for my entire career.
Sure. Sure. Well, Rick, I want to thank you very much for your reminiscences and your recollections. We certainly appreciate your being able to do this with us. And we look forward to your future preservation efforts. And I don't own one, but as a motorcycle enthusiast, ride on safely.